one thing about the 14 chapters of the mortification of sin, and I've read this book a number of times, but it took me a while to really begin to grasp the arguments. First of all, Owen is difficult to read anyway, but to read it and then to communicate it to other people in such a way that they can understand it, I knew that I had to be very familiar with it. And when you come to, we're going to do chapter 8 and 9 because there's not a lot in 8 that I really need to open up in. It's chapter 9 that I will have to admit to you. It's not just it's a challenge because of the vocabulary. It's not that. It's very, very convicting. But I put some quotes in here that I think is going to balance it out so that we don't, I was explaining this morning, we do not want to approach the subject of sanctification out of a spirit of fear. And I'll open up why as I'm opening this up, but all our proper obedience should be out of the motives of, well, three, love, joy, peace, the first three fruits of the Spirit, Galatians 5, 22 and 23. So before I begin though, I'm just going to talk a little bit about where we have been in this study. Going back to chapter 5, John Owen discussed what mortification does not mean. Now, the word mortification itself means to remove the life and vigor of the sin principle. Mortification is synonymous with putting to death. But it isn't any of the following. The utter eradication of sin. We are not going to eradicate. We're not going to get rid of sin in this life. Because it is a law, Romans 7, that law with wars in our members, not a moral law like the thou shalt not steal and so on, but a principle law like the law of gravity. It's always going to have some effect according to its nature. You can lessen gravity so that it doesn't have the same pull, but gravity itself doesn't go away, and neither does the principle of indwelling sin. It no longer has dominion. It is no longer the ascendant principle. The law of grace is, we know that from Romans 6, 1. We have died to sin. That's died to the principle of sin having the dominion over us. And in Romans 6, 14, sin shall no longer have dominion over us, but it is present. And any talk of people reaching the state of Christian perfection, those people inevitably, we must say, are deceived. They do not know their own hearts. Secondly, the mortification of sin isn't ceasing the outward practice of some sin. You can reform your lives in many ways, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you've done anything to the actual principle of sin which wars in your members. You could do it through a change of circumstances. You could do it through fear. Like, for example, let's say that somebody is addicted to smoking and he gets a report from the doctor that he has cancer in his right lung, and if unless he quits now, he's going to die. He could quit smoking, but that doesn't mean that his love of smoking has immediately gone away. It's just something else has taken the ascendancy, and that's fear of dying. It's not also, and David and I talked about this yesterday, the improvement of an already quiet nature. Some people temperamentally are born with a more sedate, calm temperament. You meet them and they might not even be Christians, but they appear very humble, kind, and so on. And if you are a Christian and you are dealing with anger, you may have actually done more to deal with the anger that is within you than that person who was blessed with that quiet, sedate temperament. For the mortification of sin isn't exchanging one sin for another. Let's say that you don't covet as much as you used to, but now you have other sins like a love of the world that are predominant in you. So you may be a slave to the other just as well, but one has a predominancy now in your affections. Number 5, an occasional conquest of some sin due to circumstances or for whatever a reason. And that really is the same as kind of before. Your circumstances and where God has placed you may make it appear to you that you have had some success in the mortification of sin, but it only deceitfully hides itself waiting for a more opportune season. But what the mortification of sin is, the constant weakening and of the power and of sin throughout the life. And two, you're constantly fighting against sin. And three, to have continual and habitual success against sin by using the means of grace. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but meditation, prayer, fellowship, going to church, listening to good sermons, strengthens the new principle that is within you. And hitting the principle of sin on the head so much, the vigor and power of it is taken away. But in starting with chapter 8, which I don't have to spend a lot of time on, because there's really two things that he covers there that he enlarges on that I don't have to spend a lot of time on. And one is, if you are really seeking to mortify sin, it's not this sin and that sin. The mindset must be universal mortification. In other words, as your mind is enlightened by the moral law of God as to what sin is and how you are guilty of it, you have an all-out war against all sin, because it all comes from the same principle, though it is manifested in our members in different ways. The members, in other words, our eye, the lust of the eye, and our covetousness and desire for life, the pride of life, all comes from the same root principle of indwelling sin. So your mortification, one, should be universal. And we don't pick and choose, but we're at war with all of our sins. And the second part of chapter 8 that's really important, which is also interesting, is there may be one besetting sin that you just don't seem to be able to get the victory over. And God may allow you to have to fight with this particular sin to keep you in prayer to Him and keep you alert to other sins. It's a really interesting saying of John Owen. It is so true. It's as if God is saying, if I don't have you wrestling with that sin that is besetting you, I'd never hear from you. I'm going to make you wrestle with it, so you're going to learn to cry out to me for grace in time of need. Otherwise, you would too much leave off prayer and go into a state of declension. And that's basically what we need to learn about chapter 8. And chapter 9 we'll get into a little bit further. And I'm going to give you the three parts of what I want to discuss, which I should have been more apt to do before. One, what is the dangerous symptoms of certain sins? By dangerous, they're going to have two effects. One is bad, but it isn't as bad. You will be robbed of your peace and joy. You could be striving all your lifetime in the dark without really feeling the manifest presence of God and peace towards you all of your days because you grieve the Spirit. But more dangerous, if you have sin that is in dominion over you, it may argue that the reason why it has dominion over you is because you haven't been born again. And then sin, as I said before, will lead to two different things. One, it wants to make you an apostate from the Christian faith. Number two, it wants to make you an agnostic so that you begin to doubt the existence of God in your life. So with that, let's look at what are the principles that John Owen talks about in chapter 9. And I have to admit up front that when I used to read this chapter, it was the most alarming to me, and I began to be somewhat in a spirit of bondage and fear, worrying about whether I was in this state. But we don't want to stay there. We want some hopeful remedy. Otherwise, we're working out our salvation under a servile spirit. In other words, God is a taskmaster and we're a slave, instead of working these principles out as a son to a father from an evangelical principle. While there abides a treachery in the heart to indulge to any negligence and not pressing universally to all perfection and obedience, the soul is weak, is not given faith its whole work, and it becomes selfish, is considering more the trouble of sin. Sin's troubling me. I don't have peace under it. Than the filth and guilt of it. We want to put sin to death because we begin actually to abhor sin itself. So leaving off chapter 9 now in chapters 9 to 13, John only gets into the particulars of mortification. the particular principle number one, and these are called preparatives to mortification, not the mortification itself. These are things that should underlie mortification and to assist us to prepare for mortification, which really only is talked about positively in chapter 14. All mortification has to be done by the Spirit of Christ. It has to be done by grace. So there's a lot of underlying foundations and presuppositions that he is establishing before he gets to chapter 14 that are helpful in assisting us to put sin to death. What are the particular dangerous symptoms that attend your sin? One, before I get into that, this are the things that really indicate there's a state of spiritual declension going on. There's really the commencement of spiritual backsliding, if these things manifest themselves. But I thought if I give you this quote by Archibald Alexander, Thoughts on Religious Experience, it's going to bring the language more to closer to our times, even though this was written in 1841. John Owen's work was written in 1656, and you'll see there is a difference. Alexander wrote, "Backsliding occurs when the Christian is gradually led off from close walking with God. He loses a lively sense of divine things. He becomes too much attached to this world and too much occupied with secular concerns until at length the keeping of the heart is neglected." He stops leaving off fighting the fight. He's not keeping the heart. He's not bringing his body into subjection. He's lost that warrior mindset. Prayer and the seeking of the Lord in private are omitted or slightly performed. Zeal for the advancement of religion becomes quenched. And many things that you once rejected as a young Christian when you had a sensitive conscience, you now begin to indulge and you begin to defend them. These things aren't so bad, or it's my temperament, or it's my wife. My wife, if I didn't have the wife the way she was, I wouldn't be as. So these things are signs of a state of declension. They're not a healthy state. All this may take place and continue long before the person is aware of his danger or acknowledges that there has been any serious departure from God. The forms of religion may still be kept up. He may still have his devotional time. You'll see him in church. He's not missing church. And he will, in a group conversation like in the fellowship that we had last night at the picnic, he will talk about spiritual things up to a point. But he really doesn't, when he's in a state of the beginnings of declension, he really doesn't want somebody to probe a little bit. He doesn't want somebody to dig and say, "Brother, I really want to know, how in fact are you doing? Have you begun to neglect these things?" So he keeps it at a very superficial level. And that worries me about this tendency in our own circles of some Reformed Baptists who are really pressing for us to become knowledgeable about the scholastics, about this type of study of theology that is more objective and intellectual, and not that it's subjective and really deals with the fight, with the mortification of sin, with the hungering and thirsting after righteousness. And that's why I always worry, for example, we could have a class, and we have here, on eschatology, end time events, prophecy, what's going to happen in the future, what does the book of Revelation say, because you could do that in a detached manner and not have it touch close to home. And this person is willing to do that, but to want to sit in here like you guys are today, or have a conversation on the phone with me for an hour, as I do with people all over the country, at the level that I talk to them, they're not going to have a good time doing that, and they're going to try to excuse themselves. Commonly, backsliders fall into some evil habits. They are evidently too much conformed to the world and often go too far in participating in the pleasures and amusements of this world. And too often there is an indulgence in known sin in which they are gradually led. By degrees they fall into these things, and on account of which they experience frequent compunction. Compunction is conviction and brokenness of heart. they experience some, the conscience is still working too well as a monitor within for them to completely disregard its voice. They make solemn resolutions to avoid their present things that they are doing in the future, but when the hour of temptation comes, they are overcome again and again, and thus they live a miserable life, enslaved by some sin over which, though they sometimes struggle hard, they cannot get the victory. So with that laid down as what we want to talk about with these particular dangerous symptoms of sin, we'll understand Owen a little better, I hope. So Owen asks you to consider what dangerous symptoms your lust, your temptation, has attending or accompanying it, whether it has any deadly mark on it or not. If it has, extraordinary remedies are to be used, an ordinary course of mortification will not do it. So we really got to open this up because that's a little confusing. It's not really down to earth and language that we can understand, so we have to open this up. You will say, what are these dangerous marks and symptoms? The desperate tendencies of an indwelling lust that you intend. The rest of the chapter is taken up with demonstrating some of the dangerous symptoms. That is, the desperate tendencies of indwelling lust. One is the word, they become inveterate. Now, the word inveterate means that these sins that you are committing are firmly and long established now in your character, and they have become deep rooted. You've let them go on day after day into week after month, and in some cases a person could be in a bad state for a year. Look at the case of David between the time that he committed his sin with Bathsheba and Nathan addressed his conscience. His conscience was not awake. It was not monitoring like it should have been. And yet, in the Psalms, we still know that he was troubled because he said, when I kept silence, these things happened to me. He was not in a good way, and he did not feel in a good way. He had no comfort whatsoever of being a believer. While he buried these things, and while he shut his conscience up. So we're not talking about somebody that has just fell into something here. He's talking about something inveterate, means that it has become long established in his character, deep rooted, and he's letting it go day after day, week after week. John Owen argues that if we have allowed some sin to lay long in the heart, to abide in power and prevalency, and we have received many blows from it, it keeps hitting us and knocking us down, and we're not trying to fight back at all, let alone are we trying to mortify it or kill it or nourish the wounds which it has inflicted, then that lust becomes dangerous. If you permitted worldliness, ambition, greediness of study to eat up other duties, the duties in which you ought to hold constant communion with God for some long season, or sexual uncleanness to defile your heart with vain and foolish and wicked imaginations for many days, your lust is a dangerous symptom. When a lust has lain long in the heart, corrupting, festering, cankering, it brings a soul to a woeful condition. In such a case, an ordinary course of humiliation will not do the work, he says. Then you may have to get to not just once or twice fasting and praying, but you're going to have to change some life habits that will not feed this tendency in you to this sorry condition that you are in. Sometimes it's diet, sometimes it's a different kind of fellowship and an accountability or whatever. It's going to take more than you trying to do this alone. There's going to be a need for some accountability, maybe fasting and prayer as well. These are the kinds of lusts and sins that John Owen says make their way into all the faculties of the soul, including the emotions, where they often take up residence. They go to the faculties, to live there. As a result, they become familiar to the mind and cause no great alarm when they appear. You've grown used to it. You used to have a very tender conscience, but through neglect and prayerlessness and carelessness for an extended period of time, now that you have become familiar with them, they don't bother you that they did when you were in a more healthy state. And that's for two reasons. One, the person who lives in such a condition becomes increasingly unable to distinguish between the long abode of an unmortified sin and the dominion of sin. He's going to get to a place where he cannot rationally and with clear light come to the conclusion whether this is just a besetting sin in me or where it still has dominion over me, and the reason I never can get victory is because I'm still a slave to sin and I need to in fact be born again. He's not going to have the light to be able to see it because the light has been put out by the continual allowing the things to fester inside. If you look at part 3 of a book called A Treatise on the Religious Affections, Edwards talks about that. In fact, I think it wouldn't be bad right now for me to look that up, because I think this is something that's really important that he says on this. And if it takes me 2 weeks to get through what I need to say here, this stuff isn't anything that we should neglect. So I'm going to go, thankfully all this stuff is on my Kindle, and I'm going to be going to part 3, because this is definitely worth hearing. This is what he says on this. In the work, A Treatise on the Religious Affections, they are signs that you examine within your character because of the regeneration, the new birth is going to have fruits, that you can examine when you're in a healthy state to determine that you have in fact been born again. But if you're in a state of declension, you're not going to have the light to properly assess these things. And this is what he says. I am far from undertaking to give signs of gracious affections, holy affections, a result of the new birth. It shall be sufficient to enable any certainly to distinguish true affection in themselves and in others. No such signs are to be expected that shall be sufficient to enable those saints certainly to discern their own good estate, who are very low in grace, or such as have much departed from God and are fallen into a dead, carnal, and unchristian frame. It is not agreeable to God's design that such people living in a state of declension should know their good state, nor is it desirable that they should. But on the contrary, if you're living in a state of declension and you're giving ways to these things days and weeks on end, it is every way best that they should not know their condition. And we have reason to bless God that He has made no provision that such should certainly know the state that they are in any other way than by first coming out of their ill frame and the way they are in. Indeed, it is not properly through the defects of the sign. There's no defects in the signs given in the Word of God, but we can't apply the signs because we're in such a bad condition. It's very tough to see things in the dark. It is through his defect to whom the signs are given. There is a twofold defect in that saint who is very low in grace or in an ill frame, which makes it impossible for him to know certainly that he has true grace by the best signs and rules which has been given him. First, a defect in the object or the qualification to be viewed and examined. He can't properly examine them. I do not mean an essential defect, because I suppose the person is in fact a real saint, but a defect in degree. He doesn't have the degree of the manifest fruit of the Spirit that he can examine them, because they have been so clouded by this state of declension for a considerable length of time. And so he can't properly apply these things to themselves. Now, I insisted on that at a little bit more length, because it is so foreign to people to think about these things in our day. But if I use the natural realm, you know that you need to check a part of your body. If you continually are getting pain, let's say in an elbow, or you feel something inside and it's hurting you, pain is good in itself that it tells you something's wrong and you need to find out what's wrong and deal with it. It's God has made us that way in the spiritual realm, that we're in a continual state of declension. And we begin to doubt our salvation. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're not saved. The problem is we're not going to be able to properly discern why we are feeling this pain. Because we're giving ourselves so over to it, we've learned to live with the pain. The pain doesn't bother us anymore. The dog don't bark because he's been shut up. The conscience doesn't have its proper role as it should. And what happens, and this has been a concern of mine, that because people don't want to deal with it because it's painful, if you're in a state of declension and you have to come out of that sorry state and really have dealings with God and really get to the bottom of why you're in the state that you were in, they really don't want, in matter of fact, want to deal with this, because before there can be relief, there will be some pain. It is painful to have a guilty conscience. And what my concern is, and this is the second part that I needed to say in this study, is that I fear books that are written to give people who are introspective and melancholy and have a tendency to doubting. There are things that are written that are to help them. And those things are really, really important. And such things as that the physiological has to be assessed as well as the spiritual, how your body affects you in your spiritual condition. But what happens is these books mean well, but brethren, I am afraid. And I'm going to give you an example. I'm just laying down what my concern is, that people who are in a state of declension, they are in a state of backsliding, and they don't want to deal with what has brought them to their present state. They snatch up books that are written for people who have an unnecessary spirit of bondage and fear, and they use those books to heal themselves. And one of those books that was very, very popular in 2020 was a book called Gentle and Lowly, by Dane Orton, The Heart of Christ for Sinners and Sufferers. And he says that he took this from the book, Thomas Goodwin, The Heart of Christ in Heaven for Sinners on Earth. However, you can pick and choose from such a book that your selections from that book, you can make your own commentary from it if you don't take those sayings in context. And this is what the problem with this book was. And Jeremy Walker, a Reformed Baptist brother, the one that did the Charles Spurgeon documentary and the revival documentary, did a review of this book. And this is one of the concerns that he had as well. He says, Ortland, the guy that wrote Gentle and Lowly, is addressing a genuine and proper pastoral concern, and one which may well be more pressing in his circles than in those of some readers. Most pastors will recognize the melody when he writes that many of us tend to believe that God's love in Christ is a love infected with disappointment, and so on. So it has its place, but it was intended for a certain audience. And another book, and I was going to get into it, but I have to be more careful, is The Whole Christ by Sinclair Ferguson, because that book is a lot more theologically balanced and better written, but it is the misapplication of that book that people have made of it to comfort themselves when they really don't want to deal with their present backsliding condition. And so he said his concern about the book by Ortland is, I cannot commend it without reservation, despite my appreciation of the overarching thrust and intent, because I have three particular areas of significant concern. The first has to do with the overstatements and the unbalance of the book. There's too much emphasis on one aspect that is so overemphasized. It would be like if you only focused on one attribute of God, God's wrath, that would not be helpful. You have to look at all of his essential being as a whole, all of the attributes. If you only focused on God's mercy, and you just picture a God in your mind that is all merciful and doesn't have any vengeance, you have a false God that you were looking at. And this is what this guy did with the Puritans. He overstated certain things. He says, I mean, a tendency all too frequent both in books and pulpits to make a point by absolutizing one statement or by seeking to throw truth into the sharper leaf by setting it in contrast to other statements. And I have more here, but the basic point is we have to be very, very careful what we are reading if we are in the state that John Owen is talking about, because we are not to speak peace to ourselves until God speaks peace. That's what it says in Isaiah. So the second concern is, John Owen says, when the heart countenances of itself. Our hearts have a tendency to speak peace to us, all the while knowing that we possess some lusts which we are not even attempting to put to death. This is another dangerous symptom of a deadly distemper in the heart. Owen says we do this in several ways, two of which are as follows. First, when we recognize some sin in our heart and neglect to apply diligence in the mortification of it, but instead turn to look for the good in our heart. In other words, well, all right, I have this, but I have this going for me, and therefore they can quiet the voice of conscience against that sin that they really need to deal with. Then that's a sign sin has taken a dangerous route. Now, Owen is not saying that we should never think about our experiences of God and call them to mind frequently, so that we might be comforted and encouraged. But when we do this in order to escape a guilty conscience, we are in a dangerous posture. He says, for a man to gather up his experiences of God, to call them to mind, to collect them, consider, try, and improve them, is an excellent thing, a duty practiced by all the saints, commenced in the Old Testament and anew. But now to do it for this end, that is to satisfy your conscience, which tries and calls for another purpose, is a desperate device of a heart in love with sin. When a man's conscience shall deal with him, when God shall rebuke him for the sinful distemper of his heart, if instead of applying himself to get that sin pardoned in the blood of Christ and mortified by his Spirit, he relieves himself by any other evidences that he has that argues that I'm not as bad as my conscience is telling me I am, or thinks himself to have, and so disentangles himself from under the yoke that God was putting on his neck, his condition is dangerous, his wound hardly curable. So, quoting Greg Herrick, whose outline I have used, this outline is at Bible.org, in assessing this book on the mortification of sin, he says, a second way in which the heart of a man or woman countenances itself or speaks peace to itself is by turning the grace of God into license. People who apply grace and mercy to unmortified sin or sin not sincerely endeavor to be mortified are deceitful and entangled in the love of sin. To indulge in sin because you know that God will forgive you is a height of hypocrisy and turns the grace of God into an occasion for license. Well, I can commit the sin because God's a gracious God. And if I ask forgiveness according to 1 John 1:9, he's going to forgive me. And he deceives himself and says, so sin isn't that serious because God pardons sin. And that's the craft of Satan and our own remaining unbelief, that we twist that which is meant to set us free from sin and turn it into an opportunity for the flesh. Though Owen doesn't mention it here, we would do well to read Titus 2:10 and 11. For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all people. It trains us to reject godless ways and worldly desires and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age. Such a person who has a secret liking for sin but will not practice it at any given moment simply because people are present or some circumstance prevents him, and who relieves his conscience by ways other than the mortification of that sin and the blood of Christ, that person is corrupt and will without speedy deliverance be at the door of death. So let me quote Archibald Alexander. again, so that we don't lose sight of what we're dealing with. The sleeping backslider is one who, being surrounded with earthly comforts and engaged in secular pursuits and mingling much with the decent and respectable people of the world, by degrees loses a deep impression of divine and eternal things. His spiritual senses become obtuse, and he no longer has the views and feelings of one awake, spiritually awakened, to the reality of spiritual things. His case nearly resembles that of a man gradually sinking into sleep. Still, he sees dimly and hears indistinctly, but he is fast losing the impression of the objects of the spiritual world and is sinking under the impression of things and time, of time and sense. There may be no remarkable change in his external conduct, except that he no longer has any relish for pious conversation with the brethren, and is rather disposed to wave it. I don't want to talk about those things right now. I want to get over here where the brethren from the church are talking about the Super Bowl or something. And the difference between such a person and the rest of the world becomes less and less distinguishable. From anything you see or hear, you would not suspect him to be a Christian until you see him taking a seat at church. Such backsliders are commonly awakened by some severe judgments. The earthly objects on which they had too much fixed their affections are snatched away, and they are made bitterly to feel that it is an evil thing to forget and depart from the living God. Now, I said we don't approach God as a judge and us as slaves, but a father, like God, does things sometimes that seem to us severe judgments. They hurt us, they get our attention, but they are still done as a father, not as somebody of whom you were under his wrath. And I just want to cover one more thing, because I think that we're getting the basis of chapter 9, and that is, if your only motive to mortify sin is the fear of the consequences of it, all of your motives are no longer evangelical. I want to do this because I'm lost in wonder and love and praise that Christ has redeem me, that God is reconciled to me. But the only thing that is keeping you from committing such sins is you are afraid of God's wrath. That is not a healthy motivation for mortification in the long run. It may help you for a while, and the warnings of Scripture have that indency intend. To cease sinning only because we are afraid of God's wrath against us, or it may prove that we are not, in fact, Christians, is not healthy, because it may argue that if you're not doing anything from an evangelical motivation, you have to ask yourself, well, what am I doing any different than a Catholic or anybody who does the deeds that he does because he's trying to appease God instead of these fruits flowing out of being reconciled to God? He says, instead, we ought to bring in gospel weapons to deal with sin. The death of Christ, the love of God, the detestable nature of sin, the preciousness of communion with God, and a deeply grounded abhorrence of sin as sin. We ought to have the attitude of Joseph, Genesis 39, verse 9. Joseph was in a very healthy way, and he says, how could I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Or Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, 1, when he is exhorting us to grow in holiness, it flows out of the realization, this is what God has done for you, he's going to assist you in this, and you do this out of that proper motive. Therefore, since we have these promises, dear friends, let us cleanse ourselves from everything that could defile the body and the spirit, and thus accomplish holiness out of reverence for God. Now, I'm not going to go into this at length, but I just narrated this today, and I think that I want to end on a more comforting note. This is a letter that was received by Samuel Pike and Samuel Hayward. They received these letters around the year 1755. Each of them were pastors at Presbyterian churches in London, and they would get together on a Saturday night, and they would have answers to these questions that was recorded in a book called Cases of Conscience. And I've said this before, but I think it bears repeating. That book, 1755, when it first came out, and I've had many copies of it, I have on my bookshelf one from the year 1800. Between 1755 and 1859, this book was never out of print because there was the demand for books like this. Since 1859, that book came in publication for 1 year, and only volume one of two, and it never stayed in print, and it went back out of print. Because I love this kind of study. I love experimental theology. It helps me. It answers questions that I have. But brethren, I am telling you, and I have 39 years of observing these things in Reformed Baptist circles, that the tendency to study this in church history is not in the ascendancy. We want to study those things that are scholastic, that are objective, but to really deal at this level with the particulars of Christian experience, there just isn't a level of love for the things there used to be. So with that, I'm going to read this letter. It's worth hearing. What judgment should that person pass on himself who knows he is in a dark and corrupt frame, but he finds himself greatly unaffected by it and hard-hearted under it? Here's his letter. Sir, having long walked uncomfortably and apprehending my case to be different from the common experience of the people of God under their darkness and doubts, I would desire your judgment and advice upon it. I know it is no uncommon thing for those who are renewed by grace to complain of indwelling sin, or the strength of their corruptions, of the weakness of their graces, or the hiding of God's face, and of distressing doubts and fears on these accounts. But in the midst of all, there is love for God and desires for Him which are manifested by their earnest seeking of Him. As the Church says, the desire of our soul is for your name and for the remembrance of you. With my soul have I desired you in the night, and so on, Isaiah 26:8-9. Christ is precious to them, and if you could assure them of their interest in Him, they would rejoice and be comforted, knowing that in Him they would have all they want, wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. But it is not so with me. My heart, alas, is alienated from God. Backward and contrary to the exercise of religion, I have lost all delight in spiritual things. I cannot call the Sabbath a delight, nor attend to any ordinance with pleasure. My character is very different from what is described in Psalm 1, verse 2. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and in His law he meditates day and night. And my language must be just as different from what the psalmist uses in Psalm 119, verse 97. How I love your law. Those words in Isaiah 53:2, he has no form or beauty and so on, seem more like the language of my own heart and ways. And God may complain of me, as in Hosea 8, verse 12. When I bow before the Lord in secret, it is with a servile temper. Not thankful, as in enjoying a privilege, but from a sense of absolute necessity, being convinced of my need for mercy. When I am not altogether in an obdurate, hard-hearted. They use the word stupid, but those are the synonyms. When I'm not altogether in a stupid, dull, indolent frame, I bewail before Him the wretched depravity of my nature and the dreadful effects of it throughout the whole man, appearing in my pride, unbelief, neglect of God, and the like. But I am more affected by these things as my misery than as my sin. In other words, he's more fearing the punishment of it than actually abhorring it. This is what we're talking about. And therefore, I fear I do not come to Christ as those who are drawn by the Father. And this is a very short part of this letter, and this is a short part of the answer. I narrated it, and it is on sermon audio as of this morning. But this is just, and I'm saying this for your comfort, I wanted to end on a more evangelical note. And this is what either Samuel Piker or Samuel Hayward wrote. To give my opinion upon the whole taken together in one view, which will be done in a few short hints that follow, I conceive that the whole strain of these experimental complaints intimates, one, that you have really fallen into what you seem so cautious against, namely, of exceeding on the dark side. You're too much exceeding on the dark side of your case, setting forth the worst of the case without attending to or observing what groanings that cannot be uttered are working under these complaints. As I read the letter and I can assess it objectively while you are looking at it subjectively, these are the things that he says, I see. I see you're too much looking on the dark side. In fact, you are groaning and complaining under your present condition. Number two, that the Lord has given you eyes to look into yourself, to attend to the experimental part of religion, is someone who cannot be contented with just a form of it. And so you are well skilled in the duty of self-examination, but you had the art of improving what you find in yourself. It should not discourage or sink you, but to quicken, animate, and encourage you to fly to and depend upon Christ for grace and righteousness. Number three, that in the midst of all of your complaints of your present condition, your backwardness, and so on, there is a real desire in your soul for gospel holiness and gospel comfort. And though your frame, your spiritual feelings, frame as feelings, is so dark, your heart so fearful, your soul so corrupted, and your affection so distant from God, yet there is a love for Christ and holiness in your soul. Only the delight and pleasure of the spiritual love is suspended or suppressed by the power of your heavy complaints. And if this is so, then you exactly reflect the character of those whom Christ has pronounced blessed. Matthew 5, verse 3-6. And number four, that all of the fundamental graces of the Spirit are not only wrought or work in you, but are really acting under and against these spiritual disorders. It is the principle of faith that makes unbelief your burden. It is the principle of hope that struggles with your fears. It is the principle of love that makes you your obduracy, your hard-heartedness, your complaint. It is the principle of humility that makes your pride your abhorrence. And it is the latent principle of gratitude that makes you see and lament the power of the ingratitude in your soul toward God. The deeper your distress is on account of these spiritual diseases, the stronger the evidence of you're having some principles in your heart which are opposite to these in inward corruptions. One last paragraph. I come now to conclude with a few words of advice. Don't aim at getting ease under the power of these soul maladies so as to be in any danger of resting content in your present sad frame of spirit. Don't be content to stay there. Rather be concerned to come out of it and be delivered from it. And in order to do this, go on in the way that you have mentioned and taken, subscribing that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked, acknowledging that the method of salvation by Christ exactly suits your necessitous case, entreating, praying to God, crying to God, supplicating to God upon the footing of His free, sovereign, and powerful grace, that if you are still in the gall of bitterness, He would renew and sanctify you. Encourage yourself before Him with this thought, that He can renew, pardon, and save your soul. In full consistency with all the perfections of His nature and pleading with Him, that He would glorify Himself more by saving than by condemning you, more by delivering you out of this sad frame than by leaving you in it, more by giving you His quickening and enlivening grace than by allowing you to remain in such an obdurate, corrupt, and carnal frame. I don't know how in the world somebody could not say, I love books like that. Why don't people want to hear that kind? That's real heart religion there. But people open up Psalm 119, verse 32, where he says, enlarge my heart, O God, enlarge it, so that I can walk in the way of your commandments. That's what experimental theology is. I'm going to let Michael speak first, because he usually has some good things to say.
Well, a couple things. I think one thing that one place in the New Testament where we see what we should think about backslidden Christians and I guess churches is from Revelation, right? Where Jesus speaks to the churches, and it'd be interesting to study that.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it because I was listening to John MacArthur preaching on it. The other thing,
So I'm making a distinction when I say people are eschatologically minded. They're usually talking about Revelation 4 to 22 rather than 1, 2, and 3. You know what I mean? Because 1, 2, and 3 is a very great study that way.
More practically. could you summarize and just kind of reiterate some of the points about, since those who are kind of in a backsliding state often don't recognize that first, what are the, or even just in general, what are symptoms that we should be looking at, or what should we be looking at and to examine ourselves to see if we're spiritually healthy or not?
Do you remember last week that we said that real Christian practice, what they term religion, manifested itself by the affections? So ultimately, the best book on it, except for the fact that it's a little bit too abstract, and abstract things are difficult to apply. But the very first part of the religious affections, where he says that true religion consists very much in the affections, so you just really have to ask yourself, how's my fervency for Christ? How's my hunger and thirst after righteousness? Am I mourning for sin? Do I have a delight in God? And so on. But Edwards gets into it more specifically in his treatise on the religious affections. And therefore, it's very, very helpful to read, especially the very first part of this book, which is called The Introduction to Part 1 of a Treatise on the Religious Affections, why true religion consists very much in the affections. Evidence that true religion, but again, as I said before, that religion which God requires and will accept does not consist in weak, dull, and lifeless wishes, raising us but a little above a state of indifference, just a little bit above being indifferent. God in His Word greatly insists upon it that we are in good earnest, fervent in spirit, and our hearts vigorously engaged in religion. And if the affections do not manifest themselves in the life, and you will know, ask yourself when you are in company, and that person is really good company, iron sharpenings iron, really keeps in his mind Hebrews 3:13. Exhort one another daily lest you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. And you come away and say, man, that really, really was helpful for me. Because if you're not in a good spiritual condition, I can guarantee you, and I have seen it in people fellowshipping with me, that they excuse themselves and they try to talk about something else that doesn't deal with the affections in their Christian practice. Anything else?
Well, that's kind of what I have.
What's going on, David?
Well, I would say one thing. This really speaks to some of these people who claim casual Christianity.
Yeah.
And make Christianity some kind of easy chair that God's just kind of blessed you with this. I've saved you. It's, you know, just sit back, relax, enjoy. I mean, this is a war. This is a fight. This is a death battle all the way to heaven with sin. You know, we're in a race. He likens it to. This is no casual thing that we're talking about with Christianity. And the backslidden person that you're dealing with, I would say, tends to make it more of a casual thing, and tends to make it more about his enjoyment rather than his service to Christ.
Let me communicate what you just said in a different way that I've said before, and that is, if you are with a person for a continued length of time and they're always only ever joyful, you will never hear the language of Romans 7:14 to 21. I am carnal. So this is a Christian. I am carnal. I feel like this is what he felt like. I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I know not, but for not what I would
that do I practice. But what I hate that I do, a person who's groaning is a practice. You're going to hear some groaning about how he feels that he has fallen short. And I have a fellowship with professing Christians. They seem to know nothing of this experience of groaning inside, because they continually do the things that they know in their heart of hearts that they shouldn't, or they have light that they're not living up to. And therefore, Paul goes on to say, "For I delight in the law of God after the inward man, but I see, I perceive, I'm aware of a different law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity under the law of sin which is in my members." We say he's speaking existentially, not what is actually theologically true, but this is what he felt like. I have this light, I know this is my duty, and yet I run my mouth off at my husband or wife, or I have way too much passion in my kid when I'm spanking them. And I'm not spanking them to correct them, but I'm spanking them because they have inconvenienced me and I don't like it. And then later you go to reflect and you say, how could I treat my child that way? And you bring him to you almost brokenhearted and say, Daddy, blow it. Daddy was way too mean with you. If you're with professing Christians and you don't hear that kind of self-lamentation, I can't believe that they're in a spiritually good state. Did you want to say something, Sarah?
I just like how you, at the very beginning, talked about instead of pinpointing each little sin that we do wrong, that we need to wage war against sin universally in our lives. Instead of going against the whole wildfire.
Well, and we deceive ourselves that way because maybe it's something that we're really focused on, and we think that we're on top of just that when there's other things that are glaring that other people can see and we refuse to see. And then we can become self-righteous because you say, well, I had that one besetting sin. I took it out back and I just whipped it. And now I'm on top of the world. That would produce self-righteousness. What's going on, Jason? How are you doing?
Well, I think it was really important to remember that the principle of sin within us, to defeat that, we have to focus on, like you said, our religious affections towards Christ and His Word. I mean, David was discussing this, that the remedy for this principle of sin is the Spirit of Christ within me and my affections toward Him, and that through His Holy Spirit is how we, you know, conquer the sin that's in our life, and we're never going to be completely rid of it. And just, like you said, to be consistently aware of that principle that's within me, warring against everything that I want to do for Christ, and is constantly going to be trying to stop me from doing that, or wage a war against me, I guess would be the best way to say it. And
well, let me ask you guys this. Do you think that this kind of study has its place, that it is useful, and do you kind of wonder why people don't want to talk about these things at this level? Well, the reason I brought that question up, because when we get through chapter 14, we're going to be done, but I would just guess, because we don't want to just deal with this. You ever hear anybody do a real study on Christian warfare and the wiles of the devil and temptations and so on? I thought, if we go into Pilgrim's Progress and I can look at the whole conversion, conviction of sin process, and then talk about the analogies in Pilgrim's Progress and really, really bring them down to earth to bring you illustrations like I did when I was teaching in 2017 in the church in Grand Rapids, so that it's not in the abstract. And it was interesting to me that a lot of the class that became uninterested in the class said, seemed to indicate to me that they were okay with studying Pilgrim's Progress as long as we could keep it in the land of make-believe, like Harry Potter. But if you really want to bring it down to earth, and I had a deacon tell me when I spent 2 weeks on the Castle of Giant Despair, and he was being a little bit, laughing about it so he didn't sound serious. But for him to say to me, "Don't you think that was a little much?" And I thought, well, you don't probably have ever dealt with people that have gone through what you've gone through, the people that I talk to on the phone, because you really open up what true spiritual struggles are in the Castle of Giant Despair. And a person is getting relief and things opened up, especially when you bring in historical accounts. Because I had spent hours researching stories to make this stuff come alive. I just really feel like it would do us good, and it might generate some more interest in the people out there if instead of announcing we're going to teach the next class on the mortification of sin, if I said we're going to open up the book, Pilgrim's Progress. The problem is sometimes families are interested because they know their kids will be interested, and kids are interested a lot of times because it's make-believe. I have often said that I don't think a lot of adult Christians can even fathom what a Slough of Despond is or the Valley of the Shadow of Death experimentally, or why did it take so long for a Christian to lose his burden after he entered into Wicket Gate before he got to the cross vision where the burden fell off of his back and disappeared. And that whole thing is explained in the Westminster Larger Catechism, question 81, assurance not being of the essence of faith. A believer may struggle for a while. If you look at Thomas Brooks' work, Heaven on Earth, full strong assurance, and John Owen especially, in the forgiveness of sin, is not the norm, it's the exception. Well, why? Because, again, going back to this idea that God may allow you to wrestle with one besetting sin because he knows he will not hear from you otherwise. And if you always had the strongest assurance of the reality of your faith, it might actually be a stumbling block for you to be in the disposition you need to be to cry unto God, "Lord, help thou mine unbelief."
Thomas Brooks, what?
Heaven on Earth. And, of course, The Forgiveness of Sin by John Owen. But these are the type of thing that I would have quotes from if we did a study on Pilgrim's Progress. Well, we've gone an hour and 15 minutes, so unless somebody has something that's kind of pressing on them. We'll have a class again in 3 weeks so that you can be there, unless you're providentially hindered. Because for the next 2 weeks, you're going to have an evangelism class.
We're doing the evangelism class May 7 and May 21.
All right. Well, we'll...
Pastor, we'll discuss your best.